This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Obama is as progressive as you can possibly be and still get elected as a black man in America.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we're talking with civil rights lawyer Steve Phillips, the author of Brown is the New White and the host of the Democracy in Color podcast. He lends his expertise as we discuss what it will take for Democrats to regain control of the Senate, analyze races in Texas, Georgia, Kentucky, Maine, and Arizona, and tear apart the Democratic establishment's long-held belief that in order to win, the party must focus persuasion efforts on white moderate Democrats. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Steve Phillips. Steve is an author, and he is the host of Democracy in Color. Steve, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you penned a piece recently for The Nation magazine entitled 12 States Where Democrats Could Flip the Senate this November. Why don't we start at what you considered the lowest hanging fruit, and that would be Arizona, Colorado, and Georgia. Why those three?
So what we wanted to do was to look at a range of factors in terms of what made a state winnable. And we really wanted to try to get people to look at the underlying composition of the electorate. Because sometimes people will get really excited or caught up in a particular candidate and a candidate's bio or exciting ad, whereas that's great, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you can win the district or win the state. So we were looking at a range of factors, four different factors that looking at how close past elections have been in that state, both the presidential and then another statewide race, looking at is there an existing group or groups who increase voter turnout, which can actually take advantage of the potential, looking at the number of non-voting Democratic voters, particularly in terms of voters of color within a state, and then looking at the favorability factors. We developed a rubric. I've got this team of data scientists that help me, and so we rank them, those four factors, 25 points each, to get a 100-point rating. And through all of those factors, Arizona, Colorado, and Georgia came in at the top.
And so let's just go through it. So Arizona, we have Martha McSally, who was the incumbent, but she lost her election to Kristen Sinema in 2018, and then when John McCain passed away, she was appointed to be the new senator. So she's never won an election,
exactly,
a statewide election in Arizona.
Fact, as you're saying, lost the election.
Right. So she lost to Kyrsten Sinema, and now she's running against astronaut Mark Kelly, whose wife is Gabby Giffords. This is pretty high name recognition. So it's early for polling, obviously, but what is the pulse of that race right now?
That people feel that he's in a very strong position, and that he's raised $13 million for that race already, in terms of they have a national network from the gun violence work that they've been doing across the country. And so he's in a very strong financial position. He's got a lot of appeal to the type and the parts of the electorate that Kyrsten Sinema did, in terms of there's some sector of the the moderate white vote, the white suburban vote, who that Democrat can win over. And so he has the similar type of appeal with that. And what people don't appreciate is that the competitive advantage of Democrats is the large Latino population, right? There were 600,000 Latinos who did not vote in 2018 when Sinema won. And so there's a very strong existing cohort of organizations that do voter turnout work. One Arizona, Lucha, a piece in the New York Times recently that Lucha had done talking about their work to increase civic engagement. So all those factors together really make it a very promising race. And so I think that's one of the most likely pickups that we face with Democrats.
And you see McSally tying herself to Trump recently. She was being asked by a CNN reporter a pretty bland question, but she was like, "I'm not talking to you, you're fake news." And then she got a video of that and it went viral
playing to the base and fundraising off of the fact that she was pretty much rude to this reporter who wasn't doing anything out of the ordinary.
You're a right-wing hack. I don't have to answer any questions from you.
Right.
And so that was her changing her strategy. So she tried to run more as a moderate in 2018 against Sinema, and then she lost that race. And so that's how she's like trying to flip the switch. So maybe if I'm as rude and obnoxious as Trump, that will play to her benefit. And so that's the new tack that she's trying.
While we're watching this impeachment, quote unquote, trial unfold, I keep asking myself, well, why are these Republicans tying themselves so closely to this toxic individual in the White House? And I can't help but think that the days of splitting tickets are a thing of the past. So it's either go with Trump or lose. That's kind of the calculus that they're making at this point.
Yeah. Now, they're terrified of his base, and that a lot of them actually don't even like him personally, but they're so terrified of his base. And that Ron Brownstein, the journalist at the Atlantic, has this description of what's happening in this country as it's a battle between these two coalitions, a coalition of transformation, which is really the Obama coalition, people of color, progressive whites, young people, and the coalition of restoration, which with this whole Make America Great thing is going back again, trying to, you know, root it in conservative working class whites, and that's what's at stake. And there's not a lot of middle ground in the country right now. And so that's where the reality is. The conservatives are seeing that too. So they feel they have to appeal to that Trump base or else they're going to pay a political price for it.
Now let's move to Georgia, which is a state that a lot of people were disappointed that Stacey Abrams didn't decide to run. People might remember John Ossoff. He lost a special election in a very conservative district, I think DeKalb County, outside of Atlanta, where I remember just the moniker, "Vote Your Ossoff," which was pretty clever. So the primary hasn't happened yet. Is he the favorite to be the candidate?
I don't think there is a favorite. So there's two seats in Georgia, which is partly why it's also incredibly strategically significant, because Democrats have to pick up three seats and plus the White House to take control of the Senate. So there are two seats in Georgia. And so you take that plus the work that Stacey Abrams had done in 2018, and that Stacey got more votes than any Democrat to ever run in Georgia in the history of this country. She got more votes than Jimmy Carter got in Georgia. So there's a pre-existing infrastructure that has the capacity to turn out the vote in a significant way.
And he's pretty moderate, right? Or that's how he ran last time.
He ran more moderate, and I think that was part of his downfall, I would actually, because we actually won that seat. And so Ossoff lost the special election in 2017, and so if more money was spent on that House race than any House race in the history of this country. This was the first race post Trump's election.
So it was going to be this litmus test for his election.
Huge litmus test all over the country. $40 million spent on a congressional race, which was unheard of on the Democratic side. And so he made a strategic error, because actually it is a fairly diverse district. And there's a lot of people of color in that district who aren't traditionally engaged and turned out. So what happened in 2018 is that Lucy McBath ran, who was a gun rights activist whose son was actually murdered in gun violence, and so she ran on that as her platform, African-American woman. She rode the Stacey Abrams wave and won that seat, and that Ossoff had actually won for.
So it's Purdue?
Purdue for the Senate, and then the other seat is the special election seat that was just appointed by the governor.
So it's Sarah Amico, John Ossoff, and Teresa Tomlinson
are the three Democratic candidates for the Purdue seat.
I see.
And then what's exciting about the other seat, which I just learned post actually running this Nation piece, and I haven't heard it officially, but it certainly looks like it's going to happen. So there's a Raphael Warnock, Reverend Raphael Warnock, is the minister of Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was Martin Luther King's church. And so he is the successor minister to Martin Luther King Jr. And he is a progressive political leader in Georgia, and he is looking at running for that other Senate seat.
Now's the time for all good men to get together with one another. We got to iron out our problems and iron out our quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect the women of the world. Remember, you all had mothers. We gotta make this land better land than the world in which we live.
kindness that we give.
I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Oh, why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can.
I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can.
Great gosh, you might.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to author and podcast host Steve Phillips. His book is entitled Brown is the New White. So when we're talking about John Ossoff and Stacey Abrams, and I think they're informative on what it takes to win elections as a progressive or as a Democrat in this country right now. I think Ossoff was kind of handled by the traditional groupthink mentality of the Democratic base establishment saying, this is a Republican district, so you can't be Bernie Sanders out there. You have to be John Kerry. You have to like play it safe. You have to be moderate in your positions. But what I think we learn from Beto O'Rourke in Texas and Stacey Abrams is not necessarily your positions as much as being an exciting candidate and reaching those people's who don't traditionally vote. And that seems to be the real battle underway every 4 years in our country, is just getting people to the polls for Democrats, and then Republicans doing everything they can to keep people from voting.
Yes. I mean, I often say I wish that the Democrats were as, you know, maniacal around increasing voter participation as Republicans are about suppressing it. And so, but that's exactly the case. And the best case example that's happened in the country over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years actually is in Virginia. That Virginia used to be seen as, if not a red, certainly a purple state. But we have consistently won statewide elections in Virginia. We won the governor's office. We won all the statewide offices in 2017. And then in 2019, won the state legislature. And so now Virginia, for the first time, has full Democratic control of the government there. And they're just passing a whole slew of progressive policies. They passed the ERA, which I didn't even realize until recently that they're the 38th state, I guess it is now. Is that now that the ERA actually now has two-thirds because of Virginia just passing just a few weeks ago? They've made Election Day a voting a holiday. They're doing gun control laws.
And anybody under 40 has never even heard of the ERA, basically.
Right.
Because this was an issue in the 70s.
Right. And so you have a situation, but they did that by increasing turnout and aligning their political efforts with the demographic changes that are going on. And so this country used to be 12% people of color in the mid-1960s. It's now 40% people of color. The Democratic base is about 45, 47% people of color. So that makes electoral victory much more possible. And when Jesse Jackson ran for president in 84, he has his Democratic convention speech. He says, when blacks vote in great numbers, progressive whites win. It's the only way progressive whites win. And so there's always been a consistent core of progressive whites in this country, really going back to slave days and the abolitionists. But it's never been big enough to be determinative in elections. But now that there's so many people of color, that third to 37% of whites who are progressive aligned with voters of color is in fact the majority of people. And that is the essential essence of the analysis and thesis of my book, is that we have a new American majority. The overwhelming majority of people of color, along with the meaningful minority of whites who vote progressive, is the majority of people in the country, and it's a majority in enough states for us to win the presidency and to win Senate seats.
So, Steve, let me pose a hypothetical. Is it better for Democrats to be putting forth candidates who may be people of color and women, but maybe a little more, let's say, corporatist or moderate, versus a white man who has true empathy and really will scrabble for the most downtrodden in our society? It's kind of that conundrum we're finding.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I've been reflecting. I mean, I came out of the Rainbow Coalition in terms of the Jesse Jackson campaign, where you had African-American very much tied to the progressive civil rights left movement in this country. I mean, the infrastructure for his campaign was unions and community-based organizations, et cetera. And so it's been more of a challenge And it's understandable that, you know, as a person of color, you have a smaller donor base in terms of people of color don't have as much money. And so what kinds of compromises do you have to make? What kind of challenges do you have to make? It's something I faced, right? I mean, I was in public office in San Francisco. I was on the school board in the 1990s. I ran for the assembly in 2002, the state legislature, and had to grapple with the fact most of the voters, even in cities as diverse as San Francisco, are white and more affluent. And so how do you position yourself in terms of your identity in order to get elected? I still feel like fundamentally, three quarters of the time, the candidate of color is going to be more progressive simply because there is such a profound wealth gap in this country. And if you champion the interest of people of color, you have to dislodge a lot of the economic establishment in terms of the way things function. But there are going to be situations where you have a progressive white person who may be more progressive than the candidate of color.
But let's take the criticism that Obama faced where he was not progressive enough. Democrats didn't like that he was extending multiple olive branches to the right, trying to unite the country. And yet, no matter what he did, he was vilified and branded a socialist. Right. So a lot of people are like, you know what? He should have just done whatever he wanted to do. But you have a different perspective than I do. I'm white. You're African American. There's definitely some things that I could maybe get away with as a legislator than you would have another hurdle to go through. Right?
Yeah. No, I used to say that. Well, it's funny because in 06, I think maybe even it was. I mean, shortly after we had first met Obama, I was talking to my wife was saying, like, he's not as progressive as Jackson.
But Jackson hadn't been elected.
Right. And I thought come back to my response was that Obama is as progressive as you can possibly be and still get elected as a black man in America.
I think that's fair.
But I think things have changed in the country. And actually, it'd be interesting. I don't think 08 Obama would do as well in 2020 because of the severity of this backlash, people demanding bigger change now. But I actually think Obama was more progressive than he necessarily even let on. You saw that with marriage equality, right? Remember him saying, keep pushing, I'm evolving, et cetera. You knew all along he was supportive of it, but he was trying to see when he could get out behind it.
Yes, I mean, you listen to the man speak and the way he interacts with people, he's very at ease. He does not seem like somebody who would be narrow-minded.
Right.
But there is very little middle ground. You never hear Republicans complaining about somebody being too far to the right, but you hear liberals, Democrats saying he's too far to the left or she's too far to the left. Right. How do we correct that?
Well, I think it's the thing I was saying about it's the conventional wisdom in a lot of political strategy is not caught up with the demographic shift. So that's so I keep saying that, but for 78,000 votes, we had a different president. But for about 80,000 votes, I think the conventional wisdom would have changed fundamentally in 2018. And that's between Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum's races, is that people look at this and say, oh, well, they lost. That didn't work.
Or Beto O'Rourke.
Or Beto, 215,000 votes. He had that chance.
In a very red state.
Well, in what's seen as a red state.
Traditionally. Right. But it was, his message was, it's a non-voting state, not a red or blue state.
Exactly. Beto lost by 215,000 votes. There are 5 million people of color who didn't vote in that state still. And he recently got so close because he increased the actual participation and turnout.
And you need to be deputized to register voters in Texas. It's a very difficult thing to do to get people registered to vote in Texas for a reason.
They go to great lengths, right, to keep people actually from participating. So yes, LBJ has that famous quote around we've given away the South for 50 years, but it's been 50 years. Mm-hmm. And in that 50 years, the composition of the country has changed. And it's not accidental that it was in the South, Georgia, Florida, that had put us on the cusp of creating a whole new coalition. And that we were just almost there in terms of what Stacey Abrams showed us that, Beto's campaign in Texas, Andrew Gillum's campaign in Florida. And so we just need to get that little bit further to flip those places. And then we can start moving towards trying to create and expand the coalition and be able to win people over. There's such fear and resistance because we're in this really transformational moment in time. But I feel once we get past it, then people will feel better. I mean, you saw some of it. I think people forget Obamacare. And so 2010, there's all this resistance, all this attack, how what a terrible thing it is in the country. But Obamacare wasn't just for people of color, it was for everybody. And then so then 8 years later, it became much harder to get rid of it because people were actually benefiting from it. People of all economic backgrounds, all ideologies, all races. And so it's a similar dynamic. If we can just flip these different places and then start creating public policies that benefit everybody, that's what's going to take to shift to get past it. Right now, what we're feeling is this tremendous fear that this is the last best chance to hold back the transformation of the country, and that's the source of Trump's power.
Yes, my skin is black, but that's no reason to hold me back. Your skin is white. Does that make you right?
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to author Steve Phillips. So, Steve, let me run through all the states for our listeners, because we kind of started with Arizona and Georgia, but let me just list them all, and then we can talk in our limited time about a few more. So Arizona, Colorado, and Georgia are the most promising, according to your research.
Right.
Texas is right one notch below it. And then we have the swing states, North Carolina, Maine, and Iowa. And then Democrats are not as optimistic about these states, but you label them keep hope alive states.
Right.
Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Kentucky. And the wild card is Montana.
Right.
Just jumping all over the place a little bit here. Kentucky, how safe is Mitch McConnell in his reelection bid?
Yeah, it's a tough state for Democrats, period. In that even though we won the governorship, which is partly why we, in 2019, is why we put it on the list, what people don't appreciate, and then narrowly won it, barely won it by a very, you know, really small amount of votes, all the other statewide offices went to Republicans by a large amount. And so the underlying dynamics of that state, and it's like a hugely pro-Trump state as well. So it makes it hard. So even though, but we also put it in because McConnell has very high unfavorability ratings within the state. So it's not inconceivable, but it's going to be, I think it's unlikely. But and Amy McGrath is running against him. She ran for Congress in 2018. And so she's been able to raise a lot of money and she's going to make a competitive race of it all.
And she has name recognition because of that.
Right, the name recognition from that. There is a scenario where people aren't even fully appreciating, because everyone I think is so terrified of this president, what's going to happen, of a significant blue wave, and that we saw a lot of it in 2018. You had tremendously high turnout of core Democratic voters, and you are having defections of moderate Republicans, suburban Republicans, who are appalled at what's happening in this country. And so if you can get enough of those folks along in a mass repudiation of Trump in November, along with huge turnout of the Democratic base and voters of color, it's not inconceivable. But I wouldn't put Kentucky towards the top of that list.
But the second most unpopular senator in terms of approval ratings as of late has been Susan Collins from Maine, which is a state which revels in its independent streak. And Collins likes to play the Jeff Flake, Mitt Romney game of saying she's very concerned about something and then voting right along for Brett Kavanaugh and whatever Mitch McConnell is pushing her to vote for.
Right.
I can't help but think she's on shaky ground for her reelection, but I don't know who she's running against, though.
So Sarah Gideon, who's a strong candidate, she's actually she's the Speaker of the State House in Maine, and she is the daughter of Indian immigrants. And so she's pretty much the consensus, likely consensus Democratic candidate. She has a very attractive profile in terms of how the voters would look at her. And she's raising a lot of money, and there's a strong and independent sector push behind her as well. So I think that that's a very competitive seat, in that, and actually even doing the research, I was hadn't fully, because much of my analysis is looking at the non-voting people of color, and people of color tend to vote 75% Democratic. And Maine's not that diverse a state, but Maine has a lot of progressive whites and Democratic inclined whites. And it's gone Democratic the last 7 presidential elections, and a lot of them don't vote. So there's a lot of potential of Democratic voters there too. So I do think that this is certainly the most trouble and the most danger that Collins has been in, and her unfavorabilities are high as well, and she's got a strong, credible opponent against her. So that's definitely a seat that's in the mix, and we should have some optimism about.
But if Democrats, just to go through the count again, if they win Arizona, Colorado, and Georgia, do they take the Senate?
If they win the White House. We need a net pickup of...
Oh, right, then it would be 50-50.
Right.
And finally, let's turn to Texas, because that's, as you dub it, the great non-white whale.
Right, right.
And we've talked about it briefly, but who are the candidates there? It's MJ Hegar and Christine Sassoon Ramirez,
right. So a lot of ways, and then...
And they're running against who?
John Cornyn is the incumbent Republican senator there. So the Democratic D.C. establishment is getting behind MJ Hegar. He was a helicopter pilot. And so there's a profile they like. They think that the combat veterans can appeal to these the white swing voters.
And that kind of gets back to what we were talking about with John Ossoff. That was just kind of the conventional wisdom.
Exactly.
Is like, well, if it's a conservative state, we need a conservative white person to win it.
Right. In that there's no empirical basis that works. And so the person who has come closest to actually winning in Texas was Beto O'Rourke, who ran a very grassroots, inspirational campaign, turning out, Democratic voters and voters of color. So I think that the Democratic Central Campaign Committee is missing the mark on that race. And so the person who I think who has the most potential there is actually this woman, Christina Sassoon Ramirez, and that she's a Latina. She's been pushed by the community-based organizations there. She has deep ties and appeal. And so, as I was saying, there's 5 million non-voting Latinos within Texas. And so who can inspire and speak to and connect with them? That's the greatest hope. And then Christina comes out of Beto's campaign. She worked on his campaign, so she can build on that foundation and take it further with her appeal and her ties in the Latino community. And that's the scenario there. And so it's not inconceivable at all in that the leap that we took in 2018, the Democrats traditionally lost by 800,000 or 900,000 votes in Texas. For Beto to cut that margin down to 200,000 is a very encouraging sign around what's actually possible.
Well, it's terrific to get a recap of where we are now early in the process. I'd love to have you on before November 2020. Steve Phillips, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Soul Live, The Pointer Sisters, and The Temptations. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.